IL Women Podcast, the source of her sport.
Tari, coming to you from Atlanta, Georgia. This episode is a little different, but I think one that needed to happen. And I'm so lucky to have someone that, I've had a chance to see her writing and see her tweets and interact with her through social media. But today we're really here to talk about our experiences as Black women in the sport in connection to just our daily lives and into current events and things like that. So Amari Pollard, thank you for joining me to have this conversation. You know, I wish I could have you on a happier occasion, because I think we both have a lot of joy in our hearts too, but I'm so thankful that I have you, you know, on the pod today to talk about some things that are happening that we need to address. So let the people know what's up. Who am I talking to?
Thank you for having me. I'm calling in from Syracuse, New York, where I'm quarantining with my parents. It's just been, I don't even know how you even start with everything that's going on. And I just find myself feeling like very physically heavy. Mm-hmm. Look at social media all the time. And right. If anyone's following me on social, I'm tweeting at 3 a.m. because I don't know what else to do with my life. Mm-hmm. I don't know for you, but I think for me, granted, you know, anti-Blackness and police brutality happens at all times of the year. Right. It just so happens that we're having it in a very concentrated period of time right now.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And for me, I was really personally triggered by the Ahmaud Arbery case, mm-hmm. where he went for a jog and was attacked and killed by two white men. Mm-hmm. And a third one was videotaping it.
Yeah, watching, not doing anything.
Yep. And
yeah, I mean, I feel you, and it's just, I feel like when things happen, I'm an outspoken person. I wasn't always a speaker. You know, I used to just, things would happen and I take it in and I'd hold it in my heart. But really, you know, once I got to college and in the past years and now living by myself, providing for myself, you know, if I don't speak up for myself, who will? Who's mm-hmm. going to stand up for me? That's kind of the feeling that I've started to have. And you know, it's just the tweeting and posting and sharing. You know, at first I was trying to be targeted about it. I wanted to be eloquent in my comments. I wanted to say the right thing and represent the cases correctly and my emotions correctly. But what I realized is, like, whatever I have to say, whatever we have to say is the right thing. Mm-hmm. You know, in trying to be eloquent, I was invalidating my own feelings and trying to say why I need to make it sound a certain way. My think pieces need to be a certain way. I was really taking away from my own voice and discrediting myself without even understanding that I was, because I thought I had to present my feelings in a certain way. And that's why I love the podcast format, because I think we really just get to say what's on our hearts and say what we need to say and represent ourselves and do justice to our stories. You know, there will be a couple cases that I think we're going to reference throughout, and maybe it might be good to just talk about those from the jump. So starting with, you know, I don't have chronological order. Like, I don't even, the fact that I have to,
when did it start where?
Yeah. No, like, this is hundreds of years. There's names I don't even know. There's people mm-hmm. I don't know whose stories weren't even shared. But, you know, I think of Ahmaud Arbery, you know, his case that you mentioned. I think of Breonna Taylor and Ian, whose door was kicked in and she was killed while her
sleep
were defending, yeah, trying to defend their home, just stumbled out of sleep in her apartment. You know, I double bolt my doors. Oh, I'm getting upset. Oh my gosh. Mm-hmm. I double bolt my doors because I never know what's gonna happen. There are so many cases. I think of a case where someone was in their home and an off-duty cop came into his house and shot him, saw him in his home and shot him because she thought she was in her apartment, yes. But she mm-hmm. wasn't. Mm-hmm. You know, like, these are things that happen. And I double bowl every single night before I go to bed. You know, that was Botham John. I double bolt my doors, our front door and our back door. I double bolt them and I check. I have to check the doors to make sure they're double bolted because I do not want someone to walk in. Like, what if we forget, you know, if we're coming in and out, if I go get the trash can from the trash people and I go check the mail or I'm running in, what if I forget to lock our doors and someone comes in and something, and like, they can still kick in the door. Like, someone can still, but at least I'll have time to, I'll hear it and I'll wake up and I can jump out of my room and I can go and grab my phone and try to see what's happening. But like, these are things we have to think about. And it's just bad. And Botham John isn't even a case that's trending right now. That was a case that was trending months ago. It's just.
There's a new case
every couple of days. There's a new case. So that's what we'll be talking about. And, you know, I don't love showing sad emotion. I don't love crying because I feel like I don't know. I don't like when people see me cry. I don't like when people see me upset. But at this point, like, what? Who cares? Like, mm-hmm. It just is beyond. It is beyond all of that because it's just, there's so much happening.
And it's crazy because I don't think people really understand as Black people, as Black women, how you have to show so much restraint. And it seems like there you can't show a range of emotions because if you raise your voice too much, you're the angry Black girl. Yep. If you cry, you're weak. Yep. And I think that's where I struggled a lot growing up, speaking out for myself in situations because I didn't want to fall into these stereotypes of what people already thought yep. I was. And then that you have adults who are not even, now we're adults and like it's hard for us to physically feel our emotions because we were taught to not necessarily do that. And they manifest in bad ways. I mean, like, no wonder, you know, heart disease and stress are killers of Black people because you live with all of that inside right. of you all the time. And you mentioned Breonna Taylor, and, you know, I think about her every time before I go to sleep. You know, my parents have lived in our neighborhood for 16 years, and, you know, I feel relatively safe. But, you know, I don't trust the noises outside my window. I wake up and I look outside. So it's just, like, hard to even find, you know, words to begin to express, like, what it's going through. Like, yeah. And, you know, I don't know any of the people who have been killed, but that doesn't matter because I see them and I see my dad and I see myself and I see my family. And it's like the line between them and me is not that far. No. It's not that far.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And yeah, like touching on, you know, the stereotypes, I mean, for Black women, Black girls, there are so many statistics that show that Black girls are like targeted more at an early age for being sassy. They're told in the classroom they're being too loud, too talkative, you know, do less of this, punished more. And I posted on my Instagram yesterday, I'll post like a meme or like a pretty picture or whatever. Like, I just want to be joyous with my friends. But yesterday I posted quotes and definitions of this angry Black woman stereotype, and let me pull that up so I can read it because I want to make sure I, you know, quoted exactly how I'd seen it. But you know, it says the angry Black woman stereotype is a trope in American society that portrays African-American Black women as sassy, ill-mannered, and ill-tempered by nature. Whenever, and this is an NPR quote, whenever someone weaponizes anger against Black women, it is designed to silence them. It is designed to discredit them and to say that they don't have a good grasp on reality, that they are overreacting, that they are being hypersensitive, that whatever set of conditions that they are responding to, that their reaction is outsized. And that is so true. And when you Google angry Black woman, two of the images that come up are of Serena Williams when she was, you know, speaking very passionately to an umpire who had, I think, had said that her coach was coaching her illegally and she was trying to stand up for herself. And the other pictures of, it's a drawing, I guess, a cartoon of Michelle Obama and Melania Trump. And on the left is Michelle, and they have her completely just incorrectly, like proportions are off, but in a manly way, right? They're trying to show like hunched shoulders, like scrunched face, you know, just manly, like looking, trying to make her look ugly. And then Melania on the right looking like a beauty queen and beautiful. And it just, that really struck me because, like you said, so much of us growing up and our emotions were told we're overreacting. You know, I think of my DMV slang, like, oh, that's OC. Like, you're overreacting, basically. Like, why are you overreacting? Why are you so mad? That person didn't mean it that way. You're so sassy. You always have something to say. If one of the first ladies of the United States with two Ivy League degrees, her words can be taken out of context and her being distilled to an ugly cartoon and a caricature when she is so graceful and so loving and so kind. You don't even need to know Michelle Obama to know that that's how she is. Everyone who's ever met her, her sentiment, her words, I read her book, I saw her documentary. You don't get to those levels. You don't get that much love by being a terrible person. You don't become, like, it doesn't make sense. But those things, if that was a white woman, that would have been held accountable. If that was flipped, that cartoonist would have totally been just fired from every job that they've ever had. But it seems to me that when it's black women, it's just brushed off. It's like, oh, that's wrong. Or like, oh, they're just making a joke. Or like, oh, I mean, but sometimes she's really mean. Like, whatever. And it's brushed under. And that's not okay. Y'all are not going to do that to my Michelle.
Michelle,
my girl. Like, you're not. And like, you made a great a point as well. When all these things happen, you start to think of yourself and your family. You know, I think of Henry Gates. I love history, and I was actually going to major in history, but that's a story for later. But he had the African American Lives special series on PBS, and he got stopped by cops. Someone called the cops on him when he was just in his yard and like was going to get his mail and like looking around his yard at his house, his really fancy neighborhood. And someone called and said that he didn't look like he fit in his own neighborhood that he'd lived in for years. I think more than a decade. If someone of that stature, who I saw on TV all the time, educated, Ivy degrees, if someone like that can get persecuted in their own neighborhood, what do people think is happening to people that are just living their lives? Everyone is worthy of love and basic human decency and care. But our heroes are being mistreated too. Where does that leave us? Where does that leave me and Amari, two young black women, trying to figure out our lives?
I think we're fed this idea that, you know, if you educate yourself and you get all these degrees and these labels, you reach these, you know, these levels of extreme wealth and all this stuff, that somehow, you know, erases, you know, racism and all these things. But, you know, I step out the door and no one knows what my degrees look like. They don't see my resume. I'm just another black person. And, you know, you talking about that story reminded me of, there was an incident in my neighborhood when we first moved into our neighborhood where my dad and his friend wanted to play tennis because I grew up playing tennis. And one of our neighbors called the head of the homeowners association on my dad and my friend. And said that they saw two suspicious people in the neighborhood and that they needed to be removed from the premises. And so the head of the homeowners association went to the courts to kick my dad and his friend off of the court. And this man was someone who we had met before. Like, I grew up down the street from his daughter and he had met my dad. And in that moment, he just saw another black man that was somewhere that he didn't belong. Although, you know, there's when people like in this neighborhood, when people move into the neighborhood, like make an announcement, it's known a new family is coming. And I think of all the ways that situation could have gone so wrong. Right. And I think that's why I was especially triggered by the Ahmaud Arbery case. Because, you know, that's not like a infrequent occurrence for black people.
Yeah. And the crazy thing is like people are surprised that this happens. Like, I'm like, where have y'all been? Like, the news, your black friends, like, how can anyone be shocked that 400 years of injustice and mass incarceration and slavery. And like, I'm like, there's a reason why there are not a ton of black people in your neighborhood or on your team or in your business.
Like, have you heard of redlining?
Right. Redlining. You know what? Let's talk. Oh, see? I knew you and I. We were obviously. I knew. Yeah. Redlining. Let's tell them what that is. Let's talk about redlining. Let's talk about the different factors that we think at least have fed into the current climate and maybe ways that that's affected us as well, because I think that context is super important too.
Super important, because also like when you think about home ownership and one, what like you, how many people have to get a loan and how many times that like your loan has to be approved. Mm-hmm. And black people historically have a harder time getting loan acceptances. So yep. How are you expected to own a home mm-hmm. if the bank is not going to lend you that money?
Yep. And that in itself, I mean, I was lucky enough to take a really great class to learn about these things and learning about redlining and how county lines had been drawn in specific neighborhoods to basically have the black people on one side of a bridge where it's far away from the grocery stores, it's far away from the good water sources, far away from the good schools, and then saying, well, your kids can't attend the school because they're on this side of the border of the line, and this is just, you know, that's just how it is, or you can't buy a house here because of XYZ requirements. These are things that play into our sports. Mm-hmm. These are things that play into why a certain team only has white players and why another team only has black players and why a certain school has a practice field and turf and extra goals and extra equipment and another team has to fundraise. Mm-hmm. But those are things that I don't think, and this goes across the board, but these are things that we weren't even really talking about, or maybe we didn't have the dialogue to talk about, but like these are things that happen every day. And on Twitter I shared incidents of kind of racial profiling and racism that I'd face, and these are just like two examples of them, you know, one being, you know, and anyone who follows me and has followed me over the past 8-9 years, whatever, like, y'all know I love to shop anyway. It could be, I love going to J. Crew. I love going to Dollar General. I love going to Cinnabon and like picking out which Cinnabon I want. Like,
but you can't play with Cinnabon because that's real.
Cinnabon and like extra icing. Like, to me, those are just enjoyable. And it's not even like, I love thrift stores. I can name the best thrift stores in the U.S., at least like this half of the U.S. and the East Coast and South. Like, I will let you know who has good jeans, who has good shorts, dresses, like shoes. Like, I just, the experience, I don't know. Confessional shopaholic. This is just how I am. I get it from my mama. Like, sorry. And I had started my firm and got my bonus. And I was like, ooh, I'm about to go shopping. Like, I can get whatever I want. I'm going to treat myself. So I live in Atlanta, and I went to a store near my apartment that had, you know, beautiful women's clothing. And I'd been on the website, and I was like, okay, I like this style, like these colors. Okay, cool. But I'm going to go. I'm going to be open. I'm going to see. That's how I shop. I just look around, or I target whatever I want. And I went into the store, and there were, what I recall, I think, yeah, like three people shopping and four attendants in the store. And the people shopping, I remember, had either water, champagne, or nothing. And the attendees were kind of helping them, or at least one or two of them were helping them, like holding clothes and stuff. But obviously, people were picking out what they wanted. And then the others were folding. And then, you know, someone had finished helping someone. So she just go back to folding. Everyone's folding. Mm-hmm. And I walk in. No one acknowledged me when I walked in. Not a welcome. I'm like, okay, kind of weird, whatever. And then I go and I'm looking and I was like, oh, I like this dress. You know, navy's one of my favorite colors. We like this cute little shift dress, whatever. So I take it out and I had a question about the dress. I asked someone who was close by about the dress. She answered my question, goes back to folding. Doesn't ask if I want to try it on. Doesn't say, oh, is that the color you want? Do you need a different size? Nothing. I'm like, okay, that's kind of weird. I'm like, whatever, I'm just going to keep looking. And I could tell, like, they'd maybe kind of look up and try to see what the deal was, but again, no one offered me water, no one offered me champagne, nothing. And I remember going up and looking at the mood board that they had in the store of, like, pictures, you know, like, you know, mood board, like a Pinterest, whatever. Mm-hmm. None of them looked like me. None of them. Not one black person, not one person of color in general, No one had brown hair. No one had brown skin. No one had my stature. It was like, that moment like hit. I was like, oh, this is not for me. Mm-hmm. Like, they're not trying to,
sell you anything.
Nope. And I was like, that's fine. I'm going to take my talents elsewhere. So I'm disappointed because I'd worked in my head, like, this was like the culmination. This is what we worked for. We worked to go and look cute, you know, on our new project. We're going to look so good. I go on the reviews and they have multiple locations in the US, and I start to read through and I start to see other Black women having the same experience. And, you know, what I hadn't talked about in that statement was the shame that I felt looking at the women on their mood board, looking at the women that had the champagne and had the chance to buy the things that they wanted, and how that wasn't me. And like, what was, like, I'm like, what's wrong with me that I can't warrant decent service at a store? Mm-hmm. What's wrong with us, the women on the reviews, that we can't, like, I had the money. That was not the issue. And honestly, it was stupid. And like, their clothes are overpriced anyways. Like, I don't even need their dresses. I took my talents elsewhere. But like, it was just bizarre. Like, and I emailed the manager and I was like, yo, like, and I found the higher up. I was like, listen, this happened at your store and these are your reviews. Like, you have an issue. If someone comes into your store, we belong, and your people, you need to train them to treat us equally and treat us well, because that was a horrible experience. And they're like, oh, well, we're so sorry. Like, if you'd like to come in, like, let's have coffee and I'll walk you through our spring collection. I'm like, girl, no, I'm not gonna spend money with y'all. And the crazy thing is, like, I've been to stores where I literally definitely could not afford anything in there and gotten phenomenal service. Why? Because they just understood, you know what, someone's in our store. Like, we just...
I'm in decency to acknowledge them.
Yeah, like, are you okay, ma'am? Like, even stores that don't offer water, like, do you need anything? Like, you know, can I walk you through something? Let me know if you want to try something on. Why would you assume that someone can't afford, like, I remember going to Phipps when I first got here. Phipps is the big fancy mall here. And I was in one of the big stores, and someone walked in who, by the store that I got horrible treatment at, Standards, is not someone that you want to attend to. Mm-hmm. But she got just as good of service as anyone. And she bought out the store. Mama got multiple bags. And me and my little just started working, barely got saving self, I was just looking. I'm just here to look. This is beyond me right now. Like, I'm just here to look. But that was an experience I had to share, because I think for all the joyous things that I share and the happy tweets and things I talk about, like, sometimes I feel like people don't know that these are things I'm going through. And like, I don't talk about it because maybe I was embarrassed or maybe I was sad, but like, these are just things that we go through every day. And I know you've been through things, and I've heard the N-word and been called it. Like, these are things that I go through, and I'm tired of just calling my mom and crying on the phone to her, and like, it's too much. Like, I'm so tired of it. I'm so tired.
Yeah, and I think people think in like extremes, where it's either like, you're either being, you know, shot at by police.
Right.
And like, that's what we're fighting. And it's like, no, it's these little microaggressions, these little instant moments, like moments where they may not seem big to you, but like, you know, being ignored at a store. And I say, like, to be Black in America is to be hyper visible and invisible at the same time. Yeah. Walk into a store, no one acknowledges you, but you watch other people get acknowledged. Or you walk into a room, you know, and you're the only Black person or the only person of color, and everyone turns to you. And it's like, yeah, I don't know how you even, you know, I feel like a lot of my pain from racism is very much things that have been covered. Mm-hmm. Or I really connected when you were talking about like, seeing these women on the wall and not seeing yourself and any of them are feeling represented. And it's like, I never felt really beautiful growing up. And the actual only time I felt beautiful was playing lacrosse. Cause I felt like no one was really like looking at me. Like, I was just like on the field and I was just like doing my thing. And like, you know, and we're so hyper-focused on this moment and like getting that pass to the other person and getting the goal. And it was the first time I felt like outward praise from other people, and I I really, it is disappointing to feel like you need outside validation. But when you grow, I particularly grew up in a predominantly white area. Mm-hmm. And you know, you watch people receive different treatment from you, and you're like, I just want to know what it's like to receive that much love without question, you know?
And for everyone listening, just so you know, Amari is gorgeous. Listen, follow my sister on Twitter. I don't know. But yeah, this is a very serious podcast, so let's go back to that.
No, yeah, you're beautiful too.
Thank you. It adds to my. Yeah, I was dressed up for this podcast. I think I wore this shirt yesterday, but it's fine. Put it on the ground. That's all that matters. But please, yeah, go ahead.
And so lacrosse was very much a part of my therapeutic process growing up. You know, things were said to me, you know, from teammates growing up that were hidden as jokes. And, you know, I let them slide with an awkward laugh, but I like sit with them as an adult now. And I'm like, I wish I was who I am now when I was a kid. And I wish I could have said something. You know, I think it was on JV. I had one teammate were on the bus, and she was like, oh, why don't you go to the back of the bus where you belong? And I was just like, ha, ha, ha. Like, I didn't know how to respond. And it took one of my friends on the team, who's Chinese, to be like, Amari, you need to speak up and say something. Like, that wasn't right. Like, you need to go to the coach. And it was with her, you know, her encouragement that took a lot for me to speak up. And I could tell how uncomfortable my coach was sitting me and that other teammate down to talk about it. Yeah. And somehow at the end of the conversation, I ended up apologizing too.
Yep. That's
even though that was a transgression towards me.
Right. But again, like, as Black women, it's like, and I do that too. And I've had to teach myself to stop saying, sorry for bothering you. Sorry for asking. Sorry. Can I check in on that deliverable? Like, are you ready to like, but again, society to us is like, and I think this rings true for women, but in our context as well, like, we have to be the ones that are sorry, because otherwise, like, oh fuck, like, we're going to get in trouble for, you know, for shaking the table.
Yep. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's just like frustrating. I mean, I ended up leaving my lacrosse team in college because I tore my ACL. But a lot of people don't know I had tried to leave the team the year before, just because a lot of things, my mental state was just not good. And I just don't think being, I think a lot of things were said on the team, and I think I didn't have anyone to properly express that to, and I didn't feel comfortable enough addressing my coach. Mm-hmm. And so when I tore my ACL my junior year, I was leading up to it, I thought my junior year was going to probably be the best year of my career. Mm-hmm. But when I tore my ACL, I just thought, thank God. Mm-hmm. I said, I don't want to be here anymore. And now I have like an excuse to not return. And I think it's been like 4 years since I touched my lacrosse stick.
No!
Yeah.
Okay. Obviously, when I've always wanted to play in Placid, so I'm signing you up. You and I, No, you're coming to Europe with me next year. It's happening.
We're getting back on the field.
New band. and I think that's such an important thing to touch on, is kind of the feeling left out on the lacrosse team and how it feels to be the only. I think we talk about, or we have started having more and more dialogue about being Black in lacrosse and the representation, but I think a lot of times, even in that context, the emotional parts are left out, because a lot of times, at least for me personally, like, I don't always want to share too much of my feelings in that moment and what was happening in that moment, and it's hard to express sometimes with.
We're back.
Yeah, it's still recording. I hope. Oh gosh, I really hope it's still recording. whatever, we'll find out. So Terry, just clip it here. You know, thinking in the context of the conversations that have happened in the past about being Black in the sport, I think sometimes, at least for me, speaking for myself, I haven't really shared the more emotional aspects, the more, it's not always what people say. I think the easier examples to share and the more out there examples are the ones where people say things. The ones where people make comments or sing along to the N-word in a song. And see, I saw a comment recently of, you know, coaches feeling like, oh, my team's pretty diverse. Like, we have one or two Black players on our team. So, like, it's pretty diverse. And that's not the first time that sentiment has come through, you know, or having that one Black player being the pride and joy of your team. And putting them on the pedestal, unfairly or unfairly, and making them the token Black person on your team. And the reason why the issue of lacrosse not being diverse is so glaring is because when players are in a situation where they're the only, they're going through a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Just because your players aren't talking about how they feel being the only, or maybe you think, but no, they get along. Like, they all do TikToks and they're in a group meet. Being on a team and being the only Black person is hard. For me, it was, I had braids, so people can't braid my hair. Like, my hair
is little things like that.
You know, yeah. When songs play, seeing people sing along to the N-word, or just hearing the song in the locker room being like, oh, damn, like, who about to say it? And you know, I commend the teams that I've been on and my team that I was on in college, like, great people, never had an issue with anyone, but I could feel that I was different. I could feel that I was other. My friends weren't the same. Socioeconomic status is not the same for a majority of my teammates. There were moments when I know I was left out because I wasn't the same. I didn't have the same experiences. I couldn't connect. I couldn't relate. I didn't come from the same boarding school. I didn't come from the same kinds of family. And it was heartbreaking because the time that I was spending being on the lacrosse team, and like, this is hard to admit, the time I was spending being on the lacrosse team, I could have been with my friends on campus at school doing things with them.
Mm-hmm.
I had friends that played lacrosse. I had friends that I could go pass with in the quad, but I wanted to be with the team. I wanted to play. I wanted to make my lacrosse dream come true so bad, but my friends were on campus. I was 8 hours away on a bus in middle of nowhere, Kentucky, like, following my lacrosse dream and being in uncomfortable situations when I just wanted to be with people that were like me, people that understood me, because I just couldn't relate.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't relate. And when you're at a party and all the guys, like, all the lacrosse guys are talking to all the other girls, but no one's talking to you, and you know why. And you're like, oh, my mom says I'm really cute. And, like, thankfully now, like, I know I'm cute. So, like, it's those things. Those things matter. And I know someone's going to listen and be like, but, like, they probably didn't mean to exclude you. Like, maybe you guys just didn't have anything to talk about. And I'm like, okay, yeah, sure.
Right, but, like, it's weird when you're in a house, like, as a both teams, and everyone else is being addressed but you.
Yeah.
And
you see people yelling the N-word in a song, like, and feeling like I can't say anything because if I do, then I'm the aggressor, and then
we're gonna... And also, who's gonna back you? I feel like also when you say, you know, like, there's a chance someone may agree with you or, like, say something with you,
right?
But that's, like, always a risk.
Yeah. And if there is one other Black person in the room, you don't want to put them in a situation where maybe they're going to be ostracized later, or they're gonna be like, oh, like, the two of them are so rude, like, the two Black people are so rude and so this and so that. And, you know, when players reach out, and I get a lot of DMs from players that are in similar situations where they're like, I'm left out all the time. No one wants, like, I try. Or someone said this and I tried to talk to them about it and they said I was overreacting. There was an incident where a coach and a player reenacted someone being hung from a noose with a lacrosse stick.
What the hell?
And shared that photo and thought that it was funny. And I had a player and a parent in my messages, my trying to like think like, how, what can I do for my child? Like, what can we do? Because we're the only family, and we tried to talk about it, and they said that we misunderstood the picture. And these are things that happen on our teams. And I just, it's things like that. And I think, yeah, people just assume racism has to be this overt thing. And you and I have experienced it all. Like, we've gotten things said to us and things done to us, but we've also been in situations that are even more prevalent. Just because you're getting players on your team and you have one or two black players does not mean you're diverse, because you don't know what your players are going through most of the time.
And you don't, and the problem is you also don't ask. Mm-hmm. I wasn't asked what it was like to be the only black person on the team until I call it my exit interview, when I told my coach I wasn't returning. And then it's like, by that time, I've already gone through X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
And you can't, there's no one else on the team to make, you know, to like try to make sure you create a comfortable environment for everyone. Mm-hmm. You know, I was protesting at school from like 2014 about police brutality and the same stuff. And I'd go to practice and I'd have to listen to people talk about how he deserved to get shot. Mm. And they're just saying in the weight room, and I'm just sitting there. I'm just like, how do you say that someone who's running away from a police officer deserves to get shot in the back and killed? And I'm right here. And I'm like, what do you think of me? Like, honestly, what do you think of me? Because you can't think that and then think highly of me. Mm-hmm. And the problem is, everyone's like, oh, Amari, you're different. You're the exception.
Mm-mm.
I know so many, but I'm not unique. Oh, so many black people are like me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you put us all in these boxes and you don't allow us to be multifaceted people. And you only, you know, like us when we're playing sports or creating music that's fun to listen to. You like our culture, but it doesn't feel like you like us as people,
yeah.
You know? And it's just like, I don't want to, like, I had a lot of good times on my team.
Absolutely.
With my teammates. And I think that's what makes it so hard, because the things that were said really sit with me and overshadow my experience,
yeah.
Particularly in college, to the point where that's like all I remember about lacrosse. It's like not how good it made me feel, you know, growing up, but I just remember these specific incidences. Mm-hmm. It's just like really disappointing, because, you know, everyone talks about how sports are supposed to like make you come together and feel free and stuff, and that just like wasn't a lot of the feelings I had.
Yeah, and it hurts so much when that's your sport, you know, like you love it so much, it just like makes you so happy, and you go somewhere and you could tell you're not welcome. You know, where I went, middle of nowhere, Tennessee, largely white population of students, you know, all the students of color. We had a group chat. We were in a group meet, almost every single one. It was like 276 or something students. Already, I'm on a campus where race issues are prevalent. We had multiple incidents. Mine are just a number, you know, having someone tell me they're going to send me back where I came from. My first week on campus, someone asked me if my parents were here legally, because they thought I was born here, because my English is so good. To be a freshman and to be trying to make friends and have someone say that to you, and like, what does that even mean?
It catches you so off guard, because you're just not... I'm just trying to live your life.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get educated. I'm just in the dorm. I'm just minding my business. What do you mean? First of all, no human is legal. That's rude. Get that out of your dialogue. And second of all, how dare you? My parents sacrificed so much to bring us to America, to go through the whole process. People don't understand. I could go forever on the immigration process. It is expensive.
It's not easy.
It is hard. My parents sacrificed so much. So my sisters and I, so my the four of us could be Americans. I remember the day I had my citizenship ceremony. It was in, I think, one of my breaks. And we went, you know, to the center, had the ceremony, and they're like, yeah, you know, we ask that you wait as the names are called and people come to get their certificates, wait to take pictures until the end. Girl, my mom was like, listen, we went through a lot to get here. I'm gonna take as many pictures I want. Took to me shaking the guy's hand, had us kind of shuffle next to the American flag. And those people understood how much that moment meant to everyone and allowed people to do that. Because the pride that we felt, the pride that we felt to be Americans, to finally have made it, to have our dreams, like, I could go to college and not worry. I can travel and not worry. And I, that in itself, as an immigrant of the U.S. with a U.S. passport, I see my privilege. As an American, I see my privilege. As an immigrant with an accent, I see my privilege. It's sad. I wish I had an accent. I wish with everything in me that more things about my being were Zimbabwean, because I never want to erase that. When I talk to my parents, I speak in my language. I speak in Shona to my family, you know? But there's been moments where people assume, oh, she doesn't have an accent, and she has, I guess her name is ethnic, but her nickname isn't Tari, I guess, could be give or take, could be from anywhere, and people just assume they can say whatever they want because I don't have an accent. And then, like you mentioned, the you're different thing. I'm not different. Mm-hmm. I'm just as Zimbabwean as I am American. I'm just like my ancestors. I'm just like my sister, my cousins, my family, my friends, my black, I'm just like them. Mm-hmm. So whatever you, however you address them, however you think of them, that's me.
How you think of me.
That's me. I'm brown, they're brown, whatever shade of brown, wherever they're from, we're the same. Mm-hmm. And that's why I never, ever take it as a compliment. People say, oh, but you don't have an accent. Your English is so great. That's not a compliment. You speak so well. You dress so well. You're so eloquent.
You're so smart.
You're so smart.
What are you expecting? Of course I'm smart.
Right. My cousin, who admire him so much, is one of the smartest people I've ever met and did all his schooling in Zimbabwe and is a math genius. Blew people here out of the water. People went to the most expensive private schools in some of our classes, blew them out of the water. And it's heartbreaking. And, you know, part of the conversation, I think, also shifts sometimes to people being like, well, what can we do to help? And you know what? I'm gonna be honest. I'm not a professor. Honestly, like, I studied computer science and business. I did not study politics. Mm. I took one politics class, maybe two, I think. Probably one. I don't know. There were a lot of books coming too. Shout out to that professor. She was amazing. I'm not a professor. I can send you all links, though, if anyone wants some. And I'll retweet links. I'll share as many links as I possibly can. But I can't do the legwork. It's not my, like, it's not my fault that you don't understand. It's not my fault. I'm sorry. Like, I just can't. I can't. It's hard. I can't do it. I can't.
And it's like, also, we are in such a technologically advanced age that it's so easy to literally just type something into Google and find a really great source.
Yep.
And you have knowledge right at your fingertips. You don't have to walk to the library. You don't have to go search for an encyclopedia or all these different sources.
Yep.
You have the information right there. So really the only thing I can think of is that, like, you're not motivated enough. You don't care enough to go searching for information. Honestly. You know, it's sad because a lot of Black people grow up in America not knowing a lot about their history because it's not taught to us in school. We have to go searching for it on our own. Mm-hmm. And I, as an adult, I feel like I'm catching up on a lot of the literature and important narratives that I didn't even know existed until I was like 17 or 18.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think, like, I think a lot of people think their part is spreading the word on social media, but it's like, that's just one leg of it.
Yeah.
Also, like, money talks. This is America. This is a capitalist society.
Yep.
Put your money where your mouth is.
Yep.
But also, like, educate yourself. Get a book. You know, Maya Angelou, Toni Morrison, James Baldwin, W.E. Du Bois. Like, there are just so many resources that if you just read one, I'm sure you will get closer to understanding and also having more empathy towards human beings. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's really what Americans really lack right now, is mm-hmm. just empathy.
Absolutely. And yeah, and I'll gladly, you know, if someone reaches out and says, you know, is what I'm saying appropriate? Is my sentiment appropriate? I will gladly embrace them in helping them shape, you know, a paragraph or a statement that they want to say. But like you said, like, I don't know the statistics all myself. I'm learning as well. You know, I'm combining my life experience with this historical and starting to understand why people don't like me. Something I said earlier to one of my friends, at my core, I can't believe that someone can just look at me and see my color and decide that they don't like me. I think of myself as a person that's friendly, I'm bubbly, I'm smart, I'm kind. I'm empathetic. I try to understand every perspective and be a good person. But someone will look at me and make assumptions and think either I'm not educated or I don't know enough or I don't belong. If you boil it down to that, it's ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. And we can all agree to that. And now, having gone through college, having read this literature, understanding the historical context, and feeling that pain that so many other people before me have felt, and we're still feeling it.
I think of all the people who were, you know, here during the civil rights movement, whose grandparents were slaves, and to have made it through all of that, and to be where we are today, like, it's hard for me to swallow, and I'm 25. I can't imagine how long they feel like they've lived through this stuff, and, you know, like, people, I was 13 or 14 when Obama was put in office. And I just remember everyone talking about, like, a post-racial society, and there's a black man in the office, and this means America has gotten so far past, like, where we were. Yeah. And it's just like, guys.
Michelle, look how they did Obama. Look how they do us.
It's like, out of how like you think of American history, it took until 2008 to elect a person of color, a black man. And that couldn't even do, if you look at the structure of what was happening during that, Obama had so much trouble passing things. I'm not gonna say, like, his, you know, presidency was all this glorious things, but I'm like, you have to break it down, and, you know, the issue is so much deeper. It's systematic. It's like,
it's beyond.
It's a beyond. You.
And I think something else too that's being talked about so much is, you know, the rioting, the protesting, the way people are voicing their anger and their sadness. And, you know, I think there are a lot of different opinions, but this is 400 plus years of sadness, of anger, of disappointment, of hurt. This is 400 plus years of straightening our hair, of dressing nicely, of learning how to speak quote unquote proper English, of trying to mold ourselves and fit ourselves in this box, and nothing's changed. Of marching, of writing letters, of money, of XYZ, of all these things, and yet there are lists and lists of names and people we don't even know.
Right.
People we don't even know.
And, like, everyone keeps on saying, the number of black people getting killed has not changed. It's the number of those killings being caught on camera that has increased, and that's why we know about it. And it's like, you know, like you said, like, we had Colin Kaepernick kneeling, and that was peaceful.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of problems that people had with that, and he still doesn't have a job.
Yeah.
Now we're out here being loud.
Still out here donating, and there's a lot of millionaires out there
still that out here donating.
Employed Virgil.
$50.
Selling $300 shoelaces, but you can't open your purse.
No. So it's like, you have to think, so it's like, okay, we peacefully protest and you have a problem with that. People have a problem with that. We march through the streets and people have a problem with that. And then, you know, things escalate and people have a problem with that. And the problem isn't how people are protesting. The problem you have is who is doing the protesting at the end of it.
Yep.
And like you said, you know, this is 400 years of like sadness and oppression and feeling invisible, not being heard, and, you know, like not feeling protected or actually like a citizen.
Yeah.
You know, people don't, you know, recognize me as an American citizen, you know?
Yeah.
You automatically people are like, oh, where are you from? It's like, I was born, I'm from Syracuse. Like, my parents are immigrants, but I was born here. Like, I'm here.
But they can't accept that as an answer.
Yeah, and it's like...
That touches on something interesting that I was also thinking about. So, in my identity as an immigrant, when I was growing up in Zimbabwe, everyone was Black. There were a couple of white people that I knew, but not really that well. I had some mixed friends, but like being mixed was kind of its own race-ish. But again, like we're all Black and just friends, whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't think I understood that I was Black until I moved here. That's when I started learning really like, oh, I'm Black. Okay, my hair is different. My skin is different. That means that I'm XYZ. That means that people think XYZ of me. I mean, in high school, I had a teammate whose parents, she told me verbatim, my parents don't really like Black people, but they're okay with me hanging out with you. Did I ever talk about that? No. Was I hurt by that? Absolutely. But I was like, okay. I mean, okay. Like, what could I do?
So cool.
Like, I didn't, being 7 and in a new place, in a new country where people, I mean, I think I spoke English, thankfully, like I understood everything around me, but the societal part was so different, and starting to understand what my color meant and what being a Black woman meant and being an immigrant meant. It's my
intersectionalism.
It blows my mind, and I've just been taking more time to myself to really understand my identity, because I feel like everything just happened so fast and so accelerated, and I had to get used to it. I had to figure out what was happening. But it's like I'm literally thinking through this as we talk now, and it just, it's a lot. Like, it is a lot. There's so much. Like, there's just, oh, too much.
I'm not an immigrant, but my parents are from Jamaica. Mm-hmm. And so I think for me, it's been, you know, an identity crisis of not feeling American enough for America, mm-hmm. not feeling Jamaican enough mm-hmm. for Jamaica. I call it like, you know, the cultural ambiguity of being a first generation American, because you're just like chilling and not really feeling accepted anywhere.
Yeah. And the interesting thing is too, something else I was going to say is, so I've been to Jamaica twice, and that is actually one of the places where I feel the most beautiful. The billboards, everyone mm-hmm. looks like me. The sun glistening on my little Vaseline face.
Yes.
I cried. Everyone looks like me. People are like, hey, beautiful. I'm like, hey. Mm-hmm. I go to Juicy Patty and I'm like, yeah, I'm just getting mine. Do my thing. But in those, the billboards look like me. The beautiful women advertising the TV, the soap, the coffee look like me. And that is not an experience we have very often. Thankfully, things are changing and it's more and more starting to become diverse. And I think with social media, really, that's pushed out as well. I can follow other Black women that inspire me, other women of color, women in general that have my essence, like that I feel like I can connect with. But on billboards, that hasn't always been the case. On magazines, hasn't always been the case. I had a virtual session with a couple of student groups, and one of the questions they asked me was, you know, how do you feel being official Black girl and being Black, and or something to that effect. And I started my account when I was 14, I think end of 13, early 14. Which is a long time. But when I started my account, I didn't want to put my face on there because I didn't look like the girls that were on the lacrosse magazines. I didn't look like the girls that were in the ads for Brine, for STX, for, I didn't look like, oh, I was going to mention the controversial, but I'm not going to say that. That's not the funniest part. I didn't look like the girls in New Balance ads. I didn't look like the girls in Longstreth ads. And I leaned on my heroes that I would see on TV, but still, the pretty lacrosse player was blonde hair, tall, blue eyes, tan, mm-hmm. pearl earrings. Like, that was the pretty lacrosse player. Huh?
I said straight hair.
Yeah, straight hair, exactly. That was the pretty lacrosse player. And I'm so thankful that I've been able to use my platform to, in some way, evolve that. Mm-hmm. I try to post as much as I can. If someone DMs, like, sometimes I don't get to my DMs, because I just don't. Sometimes I just be spacing out. But if someone sends me a sticky video, their picture, anything, I try to post it. I want to share. I want to show that even though our sport isn't as diverse as we want it to be, there are people represented all along the way. Mm-hmm. I received so many comments from parents, from players saying, thank you for showing this player that I didn't even know about, for sharing this international team that I can now support because the players look like me. They look like my daughter. They look like my son. And that to me is the most beautiful use of my platform that I could ever have. Mm-hmm. As funny as my memes are, I am talented at that. Thank you. My voice is even more worthwhile to use to help other people realize that they are beautiful, they are wonderful, they are talented, and they belong in the sport. Because that's what I wanted when I was at 14. I could have used that. Yeah. And I don't put blame on anyone. And I think the catalogs have evolved and we're seeing more and more diversity. And I'm so thankful for that. And I think, you know, I've had conversations with so many people in so many different groups and some people involved in different companies and different sports. And the understanding is there now. And there are people in place that maybe weren't in those organizations when I started that are now in there, that I can have these conversations with. But really, that's what I would have wanted at 14, was a girl that looked like me. And I was able to find that in some aspects, but, you know, there's more of us and I want to amplify that.
Yeah. And I think, I think it's about, like you said, I think some people don't realize how much of a privilege it is to see your image reflected back to you.
Yeah.
Because when you see your image reflected back to you, you feel like you don't have to change because it's deemed as beautiful and it's put out there. I always remember when I was at Lemoyne, I was, you know, every year when you were getting ready for season, you're always wondering who are going to be the players, who are going to be the promo people.
Modeling debut.
Yes, you're going to go out and have your photo shoot and you're going to be spread across campus for people to see. One year I got chosen and I was like, maybe someone will see that and be like, you know, maybe I should consider this school. Like, maybe like I can be on this team. And I think there may have been like one other black girl on the team before me, but she wasn't there when I was there. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I think it's about, like you said, the needle is moving slowly forward and it's getting more diverse. But I think it's like now, you know, a matter of like people being reflective and like thinking about like how they're using their platform, whose voices they're uplifting and what and how are they using their privilege to include others. I only started playing lacrosse because my gym teacher who actually wasn't my gym teacher just saw me one day with a tennis bag and was like, you have to have some hand-eye coordination to play tennis. Like, you should play lacrosse. Mm-hmm. And he was just, like, my number one supporter. I remember, like, not understanding college recruitment and him just, like, taking me and my parents to his house for breakfast and just, like, laying out, you know, telling us how it's going to go. And it just took one person to just, like, look at me and say, like, you can do it. And I had never considered lacrosse for the fact that I had never seen anyone like me on a lacrosse field.
Mm-hmm.
All my friends were white and they were all playing lacrosse and I didn't think the sport was for me.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of talented people out there who probably think the sport's not for them, and that's why they don't play.
Right. Yeah. And the crazy thing is, you know, it's interesting you bring that up. So Montgomery County, where I went to school, I'm to Springbrook High School, Montgomery County, Devil Pride. Our best player was Black. Like, she went on to play D1, and I was like, that is who I want to be like. Mm-hmm. My team was diverse because Montgomery County is diverse.
It's diverse.
But then we'd go play other people, I'd be like,
like, you're sometimes the only one on the field.
I'm like, it's not like that everywhere. Like, maybe the kind of three-ish, four schools in our neighborhood where the concentration of people of color was. But again, that was just Silver Spring. Like, those neighborhoods in themselves, for the most part, like, we had upper class, middle class, you know, working class, all mixed together. For us, it wasn't. It didn't even really dawn until we played schools in the outskirts that, like, oh, okay, yeah, like, we are pretty diverse. That makes sense. Okay, cool. But, yeah, I hope, you know, that this episode is a peek into the brain of what the thoughts that we go through, of the iterations that we have in our minds, the worries, the fears, the sadness that we're feeling. And I've never really cared about what I care what I tweet, obviously, but if something happened, I've always shared my perspective just because I had the platform and I was like, yeah, like, whatever, I'll do it. But even now more than ever, it's so important. And I know I've lost followers. I know I have, and that's fine. You know, I was so happy with my 100 followers, and I'm more than happy with 18,500. I'm in disbelief that I'm even at 18,000.
Like, so many followers.
There's so many people. But you know what? Those people are people that care about me. And that's what I've always loved about being involved in social media and in lacrosse in general, is I know that there are people that care. And maybe not all of them understand where I'm coming from, but they listen. And they're reaching out, and they're checking on me, and they're providing support and love. And looking at the resources I send and asking if the message, hey, you know, I want to talk to my team, I want to talk to my teammates, is this okay? Mm-hmm. And I'm able to provide that feedback and say, yes, like, if I was a person on the receiving end, like, I would appreciate that message. Mm-hmm. And holding people accountable, you know, I'm never calling anyone out. I don't think that's not really my style, but I'm glad that I'm someone that other people will see as saying, I want my heroes within the sport to speak up. Mm-hmm. I want the people I support to speak up for me, yeah, for people like me, for players that are too young to tweet or too young to maybe fully know how to approach the situation or too scared. And that's okay. I want whoever's listening to this to understand that it's okay to be scared, but know that, like, Amari and I and a whole lot of people got your back. Mm-hmm. Don't be afraid. If something happens, speak up. Talk to your coach. Tell your parents. There are so many things that happened that I wish I told my mom and my dad and my sister, and I waited until they weighed so heavy on me before I told them. And I know why. You know, I didn't want to scare them or stress them, but I wish I told them sooner, because I think these burdens are a little bit easier to carry when there's more than just you. But your voice is worth it and worthwhile listening to, and I'm listening. We're listening.
We're all listening.
We feel you. And we're here. Mm-hmm. And what's happening right now sucks. I keep going back when people ask me how I feel, like, I'm being real honest. I'm like, I'm sad and I'm frustrated and I'm so tired. I'm exhausted. On Friday, I sit up until 3 or 4 just watching the news. I couldn't stop watching the news. Social media, something that I love, something that I turn to for solace, is Black death everywhere. Black people dying. The good thing, I guess, is that, you know, we're seeing more and more accountability because there are videos available. The bad thing is, when I wake up, I have to see someone else dying. Every month, I see another video. Now it's every day. I see police brutality. I see someone getting shot out with the pellets. I see someone getting arrested. I see a young woman from Spelman being pulled out of her car. That could have been me. Mm-hmm. I could have been driving and just in the wrong place at the wrong time. So much, like, I don't share things anymore. I don't send links to my friends of, look at this person getting dragged out of their car, because they already see it. It's everywhere.
24/7.
So even if that trauma isn't happening to me, I see it, I hear it, I feel it. I live close enough to one of the areas that looters might have potentially been targeting. I can see the fire trucks and the cop cars driving towards that direction. I could see them. I could see the helicopters from my balcony. And that was something I had to feel, and being like, my parents are not here. If something happens to me, I'm by myself. Like, I have my roommate, but like, we're two small stature black girls. Like, black women, what are we gonna do? Mm-hmm. I don't wanna be scared. I wanna love my city. I wanna feel, I'm trying to live my best life. I'm in a metropolitan city, okay?
You're in Atlanta.
I wanna go to brunch. I wanna see my favorite artists. I wanna feel like, I'm gonna put on the navy dress and the cute shoes and go with my friends and live my best life. And that's the idea that I have in my head, and that's what I've held on to as I worked my whole life to succeed, quote unquote, but I know that that's not the reality. And maybe I'll have those moments, and I've had those moments in the past, but we need to address what's going on.
Yeah. Because too often it feels like for every good moment, like you feel really free and just like not, it's just like there's something that happens to remind you that like your body is also not your, is not your own body and could be taken away from you at any second.
Absolutely.
Your humanity can be taken away from you.
Yep.
At any second.
It's not yours. It's not, you're not you. People don't see you. People see the commodity that is you. And black womanhood in itself, I think there are so many different things that we could talk about black women, about how the media views us, both in, you know, in the angry black woman stereotype, but in music videos, in movies. Those are things that we combat. It's hard. There's a totem pole and we're at the bottom.
It's not even, it's factual.
Yeah.
We're literally at the bottom.
We're literally at the bottom. So like, be extra nice to the black women in your life, please, because
we lift them up.
We are tired of smiling.
Yeah.
We are very sad and just, I just want a Cinnabon. I don't even know if the Cinnabon is open. There's a curfew.
Is it 8 p.m.?
It's 9. And y'all know I don't cook, but I'm gonna have to cook today. But listen, I just hope everyone is safe out there if you're protesting.
Mm-hmm.
Take care of yourselves. I'm with you. I support you. We needed to have this conversation. We needed to share our thoughts, and we'll share our thoughts. In addition, you know, there'll be, we'll each have pieces coming out that'll be in print and online and circulated, but I wanted people to hear our voices too and know who we were. And I think that's what the Inside Lacrosse, you know, community and our colleagues wanted and knew we would. They probably knew we were going to do it anyway, but I'm thankful, and no one's making me say this, so I know someone's like, I asked you about the name drop, but I'm thankful to work with and alongside people that care and know that, like, I can't just talk about lacrosse right now. Like, I can't. There are so many other things I want to say and talk about and feel and think through. And I'm thankful that I have this platform and, you know, I'm able to make connections and now know you and, you know, have additional people that I can lean on to think through this and to work through it, because that girl is emotional.
And rightfully so.
Yeah, and I'm not sorry. Sorry, not sorry.
Not sorry.
Sorry. Right. Uh-huh.
Thank you for letting me join you today. It's been very therapeutic for me, to say the least.
Okay. Well, all right. I don't feel like crying as much as I did before. Like, I took a nap because I was sad.
Right.
I had to take my nap, and you know, there might be additional episodes after this where we talk more, because there's so much
to cover.
Yeah. If anyone listening wants to send a story, wants us to discuss the story, wants to come on and talk to us, like, I want that. This is an open forum. I wouldn't be here without my friends that listen, everyone that listens and shares their stories. And no matter if it's a happy or sad story, every story matters and we need to talk about it. So anyone who wants to share their experience, like, please, you know, reach out to me at Official Wax Girl on Twitter, Instagram. Amari, what's your at?
Amari Dawn, AmariDawn on both Instagram and Twitter.
Yeah, because we're consistent, because we know you need to be able to find us. and, you know, thank you everyone for listening in. Thank you, Amari, for joining me. And
thank you.
I know we'll keep checking in on each other, and the optimist in me has to say, you know, it's going to be, I hate to say it's going to be okay, but we're going to make it. Mm-hmm. Yes, that sounds just like it's going to be. I don't know what to say. I have to adopt the optimism in there. That's just how I am. Like, I have to.
I mean, that's how you survive, right?
Yeah, honestly.
Like, you have to have that thing to keep moving towards. Otherwise, like, we just stay inside.
Yeah, literally, which we've been doing, and now we have to. I don't do much. But justice. Mm-hmm. I want justice. Brunch can wait. I want justice. I want equality. I want people to see me for me and understand that I'm a Black woman, but I'm multifaceted. Mm-hmm. That I deserve decency. Like, treat me the fact that I even have to say that, but that's what's being protested. That's what we're asking for. That's what we're talking about. And for anyone who is uncomfortable with those conversations, you know, you have some learning to do. And I'll be retweeting lots of resources, so feel free to check those out.
Yeah.
That is all.
Thank you. IL Women Podcast, the source of her sport.